All right. It must be raining like hell out there, huh? Because you're all in here. And I know it's after lunch, so if you feel like nodding out, don't worry. I won't be offended. I will call you out, but I won't be offended. My name's Joe. I'm an alcoholic. And thank you, Dick and Barbara, for inviting me here. This weekend has been a special weekend. It's been like hallowed ground here, especially the kickoff with Polly and Dave and Jane and James. That was so emotional. I am thrilled to be here, and here comes my lovely wife, Tammy, and my son, Mikey, one of our five kids. Hi, Mike. So my family's here now, too, part of it. So, I can't wait to hear what I'm going to say. And I was told to make an announcement because everybody has addressed the back row here, the people sitting in the back row. It's not funny, and I'm not going to make fun of them. Dick asked me to make an announcement that those rows are reserved for people with STDs, so please. Just kidding. I mean, if I'm going to offend somebody, let's get it out of the way right now. I'm going to tell a quick, house cleaning. Ralph and his lovely companion, Leslie, you are incredible. I was out the other day and at home and my phone rang and I see Ralph White come up. When his name comes up on my phone, I feel special. And, thank you for being in my life. You're a special guy. And where's Lily? Is she here? She made a clean getaway. She was incredible. Who am I forgetting? Oh, the butterfly meeting. Oh, that was very special. Is Joy here? No, she, during that meeting, they were all really good, but she said something and I want to clarify. This is an honor to be here and do this and get a chance to share. But she said, what I get to share with you is what you've given to me. And then when I share it with you, I get more of it back. And that's the best description of what it is we do here. Because I'm not a speaker. I mean, we get asked to do this, but we're just blowhards that don't say no. Right? The speakers that are here, I know that in their personal lives, I was walking down the hall this morning and I saw Polly knee to knee with another alcoholic. So this is icing on the cake, but this is not my recovery. My recovery is back home with, and all these men here, part of the usual suspects, and these men are important in my life and help keep me sober, and they continue to take me through the steps as I help go through the steps with them. And so it's an honor and a privilege to be here and with all these guys and my commitments back home. If I had to tell you, it is warm up here, isn't it, Ralph? But if I had to tell you, that's where I find my joy, is back home with the guys I sponsor, with my commitments back there. If I had to tell you one word that has kept me sober or present in Alcoholics Anonymous, because I'm a guy who has done absolutely everything wrong that you could possibly do wrong for 29 years. My sobriety date is September 12th, 1990. And the only thing I have not done is leave. And I'm probably going to try and talk a little bit about 7, 8, and 9 sometime. I hope I can talk a little bit about it. And my wife is going, should I stay in the room? Are you going to embarrass me? No, I'm not. I am the luckiest man in the world to have the wife I have, because in a before we were on this planet, she must have been up somewhere in heaven. God said, hey, I need a spirit that's willing to take a really tough job. And she drew the short straw. She became my wife. She says, I have ODD. I know I have ADD, so if you're in the front row, keep me on topic. I'm going to get lost two or three times. I'm going to say, where was I? Remind me where I was. But she says, I have ODD. Have you heard of it? Obsessive, obstinate, defiant disorder. And it's a real thing. She read it to me the other day. You know, my whole life, it's been described by all the speakers here that we feel there's something in us that feels less than in our whole life that we're lacking something. And I always call it a terminal sense of lack. And which makes me an alcoholic. I always think there's something out there that I need to make that's going to fix me, make me feel better. But I have no clue what it is. So I grasp for anything that looks like it might make me feel better. And I always hope somebody, you know, Bill says that I'm proof to the world I was important. You know, the drive for success was on. And I always thought I was going to be discovered. Somebody was going to discover me. I don't know for what, but I always thought I was going to be discovered. Because I don't know what it is that's wrong with me. It's like a guy who wets the bed. Right? If there's any bedwetters out there, I was a bedwetter. If there's any bedwetters out there, you know it's an embarrassing thing, but it's not like you can go to school and go, hey Scott, I'm having trouble pissing the bed. What do you do about that? It's a secret. There's something in me that feels deficient, that feels wrong, and I can't share it with somebody else. So I don't know. And I hope one day somebody's going to go, and that's what happened with my wife when she read that. She goes, I know what's wrong with you. What? Obsessive? No. Obstinate, defiant disorder. See, all my life I thought somebody was going to come to me and go, ah, I know it. This is what they were going to just, and they were going to tell me what it is I was missing. And I knew it was going to be something so earth-shattering that it was going to change the way I would finally figure out what my issue was. And I thought it was going to be profound, like, I got it. You're a woman. No. Or something as profound as that. The speaker, and James was wonderful this morning. And I'm so looking forward to tomorrow morning with Polly and Ralph. That'll be a wonderful day to climax this entire weekend. I'm going to tell you a little Sandy Beach story because somebody mentioned Sandy Beach. And, you know, when they mentioned Sandy and Bob B and Clancy and Tom I and Keith, you know, these guys, and if there was a Mount Rushmore of AA, those faces would be on it. Well, don't shake your head. You'd be on it too, Polly. And they would be on it. And we don't put people on pedestals, but if you don't have people that you emulate, you will not grow. And there are people. I think we all leave here, and what we do is we bring our weak spots and we bring our strong spots and we exchange. My strong spots help your weak spots. Your strong spots help my weak spots. And when we leave here on Sunday, you're going to find, I hope you find what I always find. I get inspired. I get kicked upstairs. I want to be just a little bit more conscious in my life. I want to be just a little bit more loving and present to the people in my life. And I hope you find that this weekend. And when we do, we'll go back to our respected areas and we'll change the world just a little bit, just a tiny little bit. We'll bring a little bit more light to wherever we go back to. And I really didn't care about that when I first got here. But here's my favorite Sandy Beach story. See, you almost let me get sidetracked. Sandy was his home group was the Yana Club in Tampa. And I heard him tell this story. I thought it was how appropriate because, and he would go to the, and anybody who knew Sandy, look at him, his picture's there at the end. He looked like your grandfather. And he was the type of guy when he talked, he could read the phone book and you would be mesmerized. He was like listening to Sandy Beach was like sitting at the knee of your dad telling you the story of Christmas. You would go, tell it again, Dad. Come on, tell it again. And you could hear it over and over and over again. There was just something about the way he said it. And So he was coming to his club, and it's a clubhouse, the Yana Club in Tampa. And, you know, everybody stands outside, and it's typical AA, styrofoam and nicotine. And nowadays we have, in my usual suspects men's group in Florida, which it's about 80 guys, and 70% of them are under a year and under 30. So we have an AA starter kit. And I don't know if I told you about it. Did I tell you about it, Ralph? Our AA starter kit is a flat brim cap, vape gun. It's a phone with Tinder and plenty of fish already downloaded. A Red Bull and an unused big book. That's our AA beginner kit that we give out at our men's meeting. And so Sandy sees, so this woman is walking her dog. Nice elderly woman walking her dog and sees Sandy, grandfather, conservative type, get out of his car across the street. And he's getting ready to walk over there, and she notices him and she says, "Excuse me, sir, are you going over there with those people?" And he goes, "Yeah, I am." And she said, "What? I've always wondered what goes on over there." And he didn't want to blow our anonymity and say, "Oh, they're a bunch of alcoholics or drug addicts or something," you know. So he thought for a minute, and what he said was, "Those are people who need help living." And he thought it was a good answer. And so he went into the meeting, and later on during the meeting, he shared that at the meeting. He said, "And I didn't want to blow your anonymity, so I told the woman, we're people who need help living." And some guy raised his hand and said, "I wish you would have told her I was an alcoholic." So, with that being said, I get to talk about 7, 8, 9, and, you know, let me just recap a little bit. I did not want to be here. I identified completely with Leslie. I did not come into Alcoholics Anonymous to get sober. I came here so you would save my son, who was 2 years old, who was living in a Skid Row motel room with me in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. Him and his mom. Leslie talked about that guy that shakes a lot. I had open heart surgery in 2008, and I've developed a tremor in my hand. And so whenever I go out of town and go to a meeting, I'll be the guy. And there's two side effects I got. One is the tremor. The other is that you're very emotional. You cry a lot. So when I go out of town to meetings, they always see me in the back of the room. They think I'm a newcomer shaking and crying. Keep coming back. You'll be okay. And where was I? Skid Row. Yeah, thank you. All right, Tommy. And I was living in that motel room with my two-year-old son. And I don't remember a lot about September 12th. I remember a lot about September 11th. And I'll just recap a little bit what qualifies me as an alcoholic. On September 11th, I woke up like I had so many other days, and I made that declaration that we always make, and I cracked my eyelids open, and I had done this for months. And you open your eyes, and the first thought that crossed my mind was, "Damn, I'm not dead." Now, I wasn't suicidal, but I didn't want to wake up in my life anymore. It was 5 days before my 40th birthday. And this is what my life had become. The best effort on my part. I had never woke up one day and said, "Today I'm going to burn my life to the ground." I woke up every day and said, "Today I'm going to be as happy and as successful as I can be, even if it meant getting a six-pack and just scoring a little bit and getting a little relief." And that's what my life had come to. And then I would do, after I had that, and then the panic would be on you because you would look and it would be all gone. The money would be gone. The booze would be gone. The drugs would be gone. Now, I did drugs, but I did a lot of drugs. I'm from Miami. I did a lot of drugs, but I am an alcoholic as described in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. I suffer from alcoholism, and I assure you of that. So if I mentioned drugs, it was only to control and enjoy my drinking, okay? And please, if there's any old-timers here that have never done any drugs, I don't want to offend you, but if you've never done any drugs, too bad, it's too late. You had your chance. You blew it. So, I tried to get my sponsor to try some crack. He wouldn't do it, but you got to try this, man. No. And on that day, and then I would make that decision like I had made so many other days. That's it. Today I'm not going to. And I'd look at my little boy in filthy diapers in that motel room with watered down milk. And I would cry every day. And I'd say, I'm not going to do this anymore. I'm going to be a dad. I'm going to straighten my life out. I'm going to get a job. I'm going to pay the bills. I'm going to get some food in here and some diapers in here. And I'm going to turn my life around. And I meant it from the bottom of my heart. And I didn't know that guilt, shame, and remorse, there's an expiration date on it. You ever notice that? It's easy to be remorseful in the back of a cop car. As soon as they let you out, it's like, you're in the back handcuffed. I swear I'll never do this again. I swear to God. As soon as they let you out, you go, whoo, that was close. And I would go from in the morning absolutely swearing to God that I'm not going to do this anymore, that I'm going to turn my life around, to a few hours later at the end of my drinking, to a few hours later forgetting I said that. That's how I would start again. It would be sometimes that simple. I would just forget that I quit a few hours ago. The pain was so bad in the morning, and it would just dissipate. It would evaporate because the terrible anguish of being sober was my problem. That unbelievable of a wasted life. And I would look at my little boy, and I'd cry those tears, and I'd make him those promises. And the next thing you know, I'm drinking again. And on September 11th, here's what changed for me. On September 11th, 19th, let me pretend I care about the time. It's raining, you're not going anywhere. And on September 11th, this is what changed. I woke up that morning, I cracked my eyelids open like we do so many times. Damn, I'm not dead. Then the panic hit me. It's all gone. The booze is gone. The drug's gone. The money's gone. One more time. Then I looked at my little boy and I said, I'm not going to do this. I swear to God, I'm going to try. And there was a voice inside my head. And it sounded like me, but it said, no, you're not going to quit. You can't quit. You're going to do this till you die. And that day, James talked about the delusion. Reality pierced the delusion. I could not buy my lie one more day. The clarity that happened in my life. Now, I call it my reverse spiritual experience because it wasn't a spiritual day for me. It was a bad day for me. As a matter of fact, it was probably, I thought, the worst day of my life. But I realized so clearly what my problem was for the first time. See, I had been trying to wake up in the morning and do what a non-alcoholic would do. Said we had moral and philosophical convictions galore, but we could not live up to them. And I would get up and have these moral and philosophical convictions. I'm going to quit. I'm going to turn my life around. I would try and that's what a non-alcoholic. Today I'm going to get a job, pay my bills, be a dad, be responsible. If I could have done, I'm 40 years old. If I could have done that, I would have done it. I can't. What I was doing day after day after day, and this is how I was treating my alcoholism, waking up. This is only when it became a problem. Waking up and pretending to be a non-alcoholic. No wonder it defeated me. Hand-to-hand combat. I lost every time. I got to get... I thought I had some Kleenex here. I got it. Thank you. Tom is such a southern gentleman. He carries a handkerchief. Isn't that remarkable? I learned that now, Tom. I'm going to go buy some handkerchiefs. My sponsor, I go, you know, one of my character defects, my wife will tell you, is I'm a shopper. And I told my sponsor that. I spend money like crazy. I like to shop and buy clothes. And my sponsor says, you're not a shopper, you're a buyer. And at 29 years sober, I'm sneaking clothes in with my dry cleaning still. Or I wait till my wife leaves and I sneak the clothes in. I mean, hopefully that's one of my character defects. We could step 7. But my nose runs a lot of times when I talk because I'm allergic to bullshit. All right, we're going to have a little fun here now. We got nowhere else to go. So on that day, I had a revelation. And it's like James was talking, he believed, and Ralph said the grace of God. Well, I didn't recognize it as grace, but I did recognize what my illness was. And on that day, I knew I wasn't going to quit. And I knew for a fact I couldn't pretend to be a non-alcoholic anymore. And I knew what I was. And I made a decision. I was never going to wake up again and feel guilty and shameful and remorseful about my wasted life. I'd finally surrendered to, and I didn't surrender to get sober. I surrendered to die of this disease. So that's the truth. So this is it. And here's what Bill says on page 8. So I was to go on joining the endless procession of sots who had gone on before me. Alcohol was my master. Quicksand stretched around me in all directions. That was me that day. And I didn't know that until I came here later. And I used to hear people sounded like they came here and went, "Woo, that was it. Last day, thank God, that's enough. I'm going to straighten out. We had a good time, didn't we? Okay, now it's time to straighten your life out." That's not my story. As a matter of fact, when I finally, I like to look up words too. Usually bad words, but no. It says, we learned we had to concede to our innermost self that we were alcoholic. I look up the word concede. Grudgingly accept. And that day, I grudgingly accepted. I didn't want to stop getting drunk and high. I just wanted the consequences to stop. And I knew, and I made a decision that day, and I believe this is the first time in my life I made a decision. And I believe that decision was profound. That's why we make a decision in step 3. That decision was profound. I made a decision. I'm going to quit quitting. And I thought it was a profound decision. And I said, that's it. I'm done. And I knew what my problem was. My problem was not alcohol or drugs. My problem was not enough alcohol or drugs. Because it was untreated sobriety. I had drank myself to a point where I could not stay sober anymore. Sobriety was so painful. If you're new, we understand. And sometimes you come into a meeting and you hear people, "Oh, we have such a good time sober. We go to dances and picnics." And you're going, "Oh, Jesus, kill me now." Right? And they're usually people, no offense, Lily, she's gone. But it's people like Lily going, "We have all these, you know, and you're the new guy. You're a young guy sitting in a meeting and you hear this and you go, oh my God, that's it. Shuffleboard, bingo, no sex, no fun forever. I'm done. And plus you owe everybody in the world money. So getting sober is not going to look, you got all this wreckage. We come in with our bushel basket full of wreckage. We don't know what we're going to do with it. It doesn't look good. Why would I get sober? I just am in that. We have a dilemma. Two bad options. That's what a dilemma means. You got two bad options. Get sober, get drunk. Oh my God, they're both bad. But when the getting drunk becomes worse option than getting sober, we make that decision that day. And I made that decision. I was going to drink until I died. And on that day, I knew I was going down. And my little boy was in that room with me. Now, this is September 11th, 1990, the day before my sobriety date. And you want to talk about the grace of God. And that night, on September 11th, there was a knock on that motel room door. And it was God knocking on the door. And that night, he was fat and bald. He looked like my brother. And he came into that motel room, and he didn't lecture me. He didn't tell me what I was doing, look at my, and didn't, "You're so disgusting." He didn't tell me that I need to straighten my life out. He didn't do any of that. I believe that this is so divinely designed, our program, as you talked about with the Roland Hazard story. I love that story. That's the story of Christmas for us. And he just looked at me, and I saw the horror in his eyes. And he looked at my little boy in filthy diapers with watered down milk, and all he did was put his phone number down. And he said, I believe he said the only words that would have got my attention. What seemed at first a flimsy reed proved to be the loving hand of God. It was the last thread. Because when you come in here, most of us are hanging by a thread, aren't we? But those of us that have been around a while, the thread didn't break. That's the miracle. That last thread doesn't break if we just show up here and become willing. And here's what he said to me. He said, if you want, I will watch your son while you get help. And I wanted my son off that sinking ship, that sinking vessel that was my life. And that's the only reason I showed up here, is because somebody was going to save my son. So I said, all right. And the next morning, and he left his phone number and he walked out. And the next morning I made that call. I believe that was my step one and my step two. Step three, I did on my knees with my sponsor. I don't hold hands because with the guys, but I do. I always get on my knees with these guys. I don't hold hands because I usually know where they've been. See, if you're new, and we talked about in 4 and 5, and I love what Lily talked about in step 4, about the thing. We all have that thing. And if you're new, I know you have that thing. You know how I know it? Because I have it. I know what you did at 4 o'clock in the morning when nobody was looking and you were absolutely starved for some approval or somebody to give us some attention. I know what that hole looks like inside of us because I did it. I've been there. And I had that terrible thing. And I went through those steps and I got out of that. I ended up the next day after I made that phone call, I ended up in a treatment center in Miami for indigents. And it was, I was looking for the Betty Ford Center. I wanted a weight room and an Olympic pool and, 30 day. I heard treatment was 30 days. I didn't know AA. I'd never been to an AA meeting. I was 40 years old. Never been to an AA meeting. Never been to a treatment center. Never been to a detox. Wouldn't have known where to find you. But I heard about treatment and I thought maybe they'll fix me in there. They'll give me something. I had no idea what they do. Maybe they were going to give me a pill or a suppository or something, you know, and fix me up. And I knew it was 30 days and I'll go through with it because they're going to watch my son. And I got to that treatment center and in my mind I'm thinking, I'll be out of here in no time, man. I'm way smart. I looked around that room. There were 50 people in there. I looked around and said, I'm way smarter than these guys. And, they don't know who I am. I used to own a bar on South Beach. I'm Miami Joe. And that's what they call me, Miami Joe. Nobody called me Miami Joe. I call me Miami Joe. You're really sick when you got to give yourself a nickname, right? And, but they brought an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting in there the first night, and I became introduced to you. And it was a 27-year-old kid that came in there with creases in his pants, a collared shirt on, and he looked good. He didn't look like he came from the street. And he drove up in a new car, and we say in AA, if you have what you want, what we have, well, he had what I wanted. He had a wristwatch and a pack of Marlboro Reds, and I said, if I could get that, I would be out of here. And he said a couple things that night, and he said, those are things that I didn't understand, but I think that they shifted my perception. And he said, if this is a 6-month treatment center, I didn't want to stay. I knew I wasn't staying 6 months. But he said, you never have to take another drink or drug again if you don't want to. Now, I knew that was crap because I had not wanted to many times. And that didn't work. But he said something else. This was my 40th birthday. And I was in that treatment center, September 17th, 1990, my first night. It was a Friday night in Miami, and I was there. My life had become a waste. I was the worst night of my life, and this boy came in, this 27-year-old boy came in there, and he said, but I will tell you this, you never have to feel the way you feel tonight again. And I wanted that more than anything in the world. On September 17th, 1990, I was in a room with 50 indigents, and I would have traded my life for anyone in that room. These were street people. These were people out of prison. Didn't know any of them, but I would have traded my life for any one of theirs. Today, because of Alcoholics Anonymous and a loving God I found here, I would not trade my life for anyone. If you described my life to me, I'd be jealous. And believe me, I am blessed beyond my ability to be grateful. I wish I could stand up here and tell you, I'm grateful all the time. I'm not. Listen, I can make any alcoholic feel bad. I can make you feel bad. And it, we're, because that terminal sense of lack, it's there. It just doesn't drive us. Like those instincts that Bill talks that drive us, right? And I can make any alcoholic feel bad. Watch, I'll prove it to you. Answer this question, Eric. Eric, how you doing? Good? No, Eric. How you really doing? He'll walk out of here thinking, uh-oh, Jesus, how am I really doing? Right? We're so self-absorbed and self-conscious. That's what will happen to us. And see, anytime I go in for that's why this isn't a self-help program. Anytime I do any self-reflection, I'm always a quart low. It's our disease. What I learned here is to not pay attention to me. My feelings have been dragging my ass around my entire life. What we're judged on here is our actions. My sponsor told me this. He says, if I follow you around with a video camera, could I take that film to court and convict you of being a good member of AA? They're not recording what I'm thinking, thank God. They're recording what I'm doing. Just like you. This weekend, every one of you can be convicted of being a good member of Alcoholics Anonymous. You're here trying to grow spiritually, trying to grasp onto some pearl, shucking through the oysters of this weekend of the speakers that are here and trying to find the pearl that you can take with you to go back, right? That's what I do. I look for the pearl. And anyway, I got out of that treatment center. Here's what he said. He said, if you stay the entire 6 months, I promise you your life will never be the same. And he said, but I got bad news. At the end of 6 months, there won't be five of you left. And there wasn't. There were two of us. And I don't know why I was one. Maybe the desperation. I did not come here chasing God. I came here running from my life. I did not want my life anymore. And I stayed there. And I think that was my first commitment. And I believe if you stay sober, your life will be filled with these kind of moments. I call them Bill W. moments. Those moments where you go left or go right, like he had in the hotel bar. And those moments come with a lot of distress and pain. My wife's telling me. Oh, okay. Thank you, dear. I'm going to get to 7, 8, 9 somewhere here. Anyway, they make too much out of those damn steps anyway. I just skip those. No, I'm kidding. Actually, 7 was paramount in my recovery. And what was I saying? Left after 6 months. I met my sponsor. My sponsor started taking me through the steps. I did the best I could. We did our third step on our knees. I did a fourth step, which was as best as I could do. It was not a great fourth step. It was just the thing. I got rid of the thing. Okay? It was not a causes and conditions fourth step. It didn't do an honest look at myself to figure out what my character defects were. So therefore, when I went into 6 and 7, I really didn't have much to ask God to remove. I'm really basically a nice guy. I thought my character defects were the result of my drinking. That's what I thought. And I didn't understand until I crashed and burned at 5.5 years sober that the cause of my drinking was my character defects. My drinking didn't cause my character defects. That's just drunken behavior. Don't confuse drunken behavior with our character defects. Somebody talked about step 3. That selfishness, self-centeredness, and Polly said when she was sharing yesterday, I discovered, and I didn't discover it in my first round through the steps, but I am selfish and self-centered at a cellular level. It is my being. And then they said and we discovered that why a spiritual solution to this problem? A spiritual solution because everybody always says, well, we have a spiritual illness. Well, what does that mean? I mean, what does it really mean? Bill calls us worldly. Have you heard that term? He calls us worldly over and over and over again in the book. Look that one up. That one means more concerned with material things than spiritual things. That's the definition of worldly. So it is even harder for us to transition to spiritual way of life than a normal person. He talks about these instincts we have that drive us for sex, society, and security. And those are the instincts that drive us blind. When these drive us blindly, the fear of losing what we have, not getting what we want. We always demand more satisfaction and pleasure than, listen to this, than are due us or possible. So, you're not getting them. So we live in a constant state of disturbance. I was in a constant state of disturbance. Everything pissed me off. Now, I didn't care. I was so selfish. I didn't care about a lot of people I didn't understand that in the fourth step, I came to one realization that I was in competition with everybody. Life is like a big pizza when you live in a worldly, when you do that fear inventory and he says, why do we have these fears? Isn't it because self-reliance failed us? And I started to realize, what's self-reliance? What does that mean? That means that life is like a big giant pizza. There's 8 slices. It's great as long as I'm getting my slices. But you get a slice and secretly, not only I am jealous. And I don't care if I got 6 slices and you only get 1. When we see the needs of others met or the wants of others met, it affects us. And I live on that constant state of disturbance. It's not enough. There's never enough of what we think we need. Never. So I didn't understand this my first trip through the steps. I meet my beautiful wife, Tammy. Those 5 things you described, I'm not going to remember them, but I know those 5 things that James talked about that makes us an alcoholic. Bingo. I got all 5. Okay. This is the first one. I've been married and divorced to the same woman and remarried in sobriety. I met my wife, fell madly in love with her. I loved her before I met her. She worked at Intergroup with my sponsor, Frank. He would come home and tell me about this woman that was an angel, and she is an angel. She's my North Star, my guiding light. And I became an AA stalker before I ever met her. I went to Intergroup and pretended to just be looking for Frank and my sponsor and, ended up meeting her. We fell madly in love, got married. She had 2 kids. By this time I got custody of my son. His mother never did get sober, and I was a single dad, and that we got together, and it was, but you know, when you stop committing felonies on a daily basis and show up for work, your life gets better. My life started to get better. I was, and I started to get promoted at work. I started to get ahead at work, and the next thing you know, we got married, we dragged it, and I got a big job offer to move to South Florida again. And we moved down to South Florida. I dragged my wife and my kids. And this might be an indication you're running on self-will when you say something like this. I'm going with or without you. Because this was the best job offer I'd ever had in my life. The reason it was the best, it's because I didn't deserve it. I was not really qualified for it. And I needed to take this job because it was a position that I really would never get. Wasn't ready to get. But I took the job, paid more money than I'd ever had in my life, and I had stopped coming to you. I was too busy trying to prove myself at work. And I got sideways. And at 5 years sober, we're married, we're living in West Palm Beach, and the fights start. We're only married a short time, about a year, and the fights became really bad. And one day I come home, and I'm working 14 hours a day. And now, you know what? I'm not going to you. And little by little, I started to do some things, those character defects. You know, Bill talks about, it's not the big ones. It's the little ones we do. It's like lying about my dry cleaning. I do it because I'm so good at it. I just want to stay in practice. At least I used to be good. I suck at it now. She catches me every time. But the truth is I started to do some things that were dishonest. I started to hedge my bet in that relationship. I started to hide some money just because she's fighting a lot. I don't know why. And this thing may not last. You know, we're to throw the baby out with the bathwater. I can see that coming here. And I'm getting caught up in my ego again. And one day, and I'm going home, exhausted, working 12, 14 hours a day, and I put a cardboard cutout of a husband up. and I think I'm fooling her. And I put a cardboard cutout of a dad up, and I think I'm fooling my kids. And I'm not. I'm only fooling me. I'm not fooling anybody else. And one day I go home, and she says, I want a divorce. If this is what it's like, I want to be alone. And packed my son up, my life up out of that house, and walked out of that house. And the last thing she said to me as I left was, can't you see that all your relationships end the same? And I couldn't see it. I couldn't see it when she said it. But my next journey through the steps, 4 and 5, I saw those causes and conditions. I saw that selfishness, self-centeredness, what it's done in my life. And I was so angry and so affected by this that a short time later they fired me from this best job I ever had. So now I'm 6 years sober. I'm divorced. And it's just like wetting a bed. I can't tell you I peed the bed. But I peed the bed here. And I'm 6 years sober, and I can't come to meetings and tell you. I should be doing a lot better than this. I've lost my job. My wife divorced me. I'm broke again. And this is what sobriety looks like. I'm so angry with God. I can't eat. I can't sleep. And I meet some guys. And it was a miracle. I meet these guys. I want to drink more and I want to stay sober. I'm driving. I see a bar that I want to go in. I said, that's it. If this is sobriety, God, the hell with you, you can have it. And I cursed God that night. I left my little boy asleep in the back room of that apartment that we were in. And I drove across town to this bar. And it had a name that caught my attention. It said Bar. And it opened at 8 a.m. It had a parking lot in the back. I can be a big shot in there for a little while because it's who I am. I'm Miami Joe. And I was outside that bar. It was a block away, and I'm going to drink. And it's hard to drink when you got 6 years sober. I got butterflies in my stomach because I know one thing. I had unworked the steps all the way back to step one, part A. When I take this drink, my lifestyle is about to change. That was the only thing I knew. And I would probably not even go home for my son. I won't know when I'll surface. And I was stopped at a red light, and I looked over here underneath the street light. There was a broken down van with its hood up, and it said, have you prayed today? And while I was at that red light, I said the serenity prayer. And I ended up driving across town. I didn't go to that bar. It was almost like a blackout. I went across town to a meeting I'd been to one time a year earlier, and I walked in. And there were almost this many people at this meeting. It was in West Palm, and there was a guy on the podium. And he said, this is anniversary night. We have 5 or 6 celebrants here. Is there anybody celebrating an anniversary in the month of September? And like an idiot, I was sitting in the STD row, right? And like an idiot, I raised my hand. It was my 6th-year anniversary. And he said, we have 5 or 6 celebrants here, and what they do is come up and share for about 10 minutes how they stayed sober. We have a visitor. Why don't you start us off? Oh, yeah, it was real funny that night. So I come up to the microphone at 6 years sober, absolutely in disguise, hiding from you. And I get up to the microphone, I turn around, and the kindness of strangers, I see it in your face. See, most of us are here because of the kindness of strangers. Somebody loved us before we loved ourselves. I never loved anybody. And I turned around, I looked out, and I saw your faces, and I started to cry. I couldn't talk. Then I started to sob. And the only thing I could get out of my mouth in about 5 minutes was, I don't know how to do this anymore. I'm lost. I need help. And two men came and they rushed me off the stage. They took me back in the kitchen. I found out why, because they had the treatment center had all the new guys in the front row, right? True. And he, you know, they go, that's not how it is at 6 years sober. He's just humble. I am not humble. And, but these two guys stayed with me till 11:30 that night. They grabbed me at 7:30 in the morning because they knew I was in a fragile position. They lived the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. Just like old-fashioned AA. They were doing a nose count. Isn't that what you said? He's with us. They would keep guys locked up in those days. You're going to stay here, so we got you sober. We can count you as a sober guy. And they said, we're going to show you how to do this one more time. They took me back through the steps. They took me into detoxes and treatment centers and prisons and started me sponsoring guys again. And I started to live the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I surrendered at a deeper level than I'd ever surrendered. It didn't happen immediately, but I knew. You can have all of my life now. Before that I had an alcoholic life, then I had a married life, and I had a work life, and I had a finance life. They're not separate. There's no separation of church and state in my life anymore. My recovery is what I do for a living. My job is what I do to support my livelihood. This is it. I am with you today. I would pay to come here. Oh, you did. Wouldn't we though, Ralph? We would pay to come here. I would. This is it, man. So when these guys took me through the steps again, I started to discover, especially in that fourth step, fourth and fifth, that I did found out some causes and conditions. And step seven became, six and seven, I don't want to steal about six, but six and seven became so paramount in my life because they were nothing the first time I went through. They were a couple things and you said the prayer and you move on, right? Okay, God, where's my miracle? Take away the selfishness. Take away this, I was going to say lust, but no, don't take away that. But right? Like Sandy says, take away 60% of my lust. Just enough so I'm not a rapist. That's what he used to say, right? And he used to say, I don't want to be rich. I just want to have enough money where I don't need God. That's why we love Sandy. So what happened was, as I started, and I'm going to tell you that step six and seven opened a door for me. It's about, and I was taught, it's about character building. It's about anyone, it says, this is the step that separates the men from the boys. That doesn't seem like a very hard step to separate the men from. It does. It's about commitment. It's about changing our perspective. I don't need God. I'm going to tell you the truth. God is insufficient for me. I need a loving God. Because sooner or later, it's been bred into me that God is some big mysterious thing over here, and if I screw up, maybe he'll be mad. No, that God doesn't exist anymore. I need a loving God in my life, and I have one today. And it came to me in the process of six and seven. I was sitting out back in my yard one day, and I was watching some squirrels, and I was in the process of six and seven. Now, if you ever watch squirrels, and I thought, these poor things, they're like tree rats. They're the rats of trees, okay? Nobody wants to be a squirrel. I want to be a bird. If I'm going to be something, I want to be a bird. But I'm watching these little squirrels. I threw some nuts out one day, and we had this canopy of oak trees, and I was watching all of a sudden one day, and I'm thinking about changing my perspective, being okay with me, good and bad. God created me. And I'm watching these squirrels, and did you ever notice that a squirrel can run on the bottom side of a limb? They don't have gravity. Take a look. Gravity doesn't exist for squirrels. They can run down a tree. They can run underneath. They run full speed through the tops of the trees, jumping from tree to tree, like there's some highway up there that they see that we don't see. And I'm watching them, and I'm thinking, and they're running full speed. And then there's this little squirrel sitting in front of me eating, and I'm thinking, you know what? He's just sitting there content, eating, being him squirrel self. He's not looking to go, and you know what? I want to be a good squirrel today. Or he's not looking at the other squirrel over there, goes, I want to be that squirrel. He gets all the girl squirrels. Or he's looking at me and he's, I don't even want to be him, and he's the guy with the nuts. I'm the guy that is nuts. Okay? And I'm thinking, it's in his DNA to be okay with who he is. And when he's okay with who he is, he has superpowers. Gravity doesn't exist. He is absolutely perfect with what he was created to be. And step seven is where I come to that conclusion. I am absolutely perfect. We strive for an ideal. For God's, we change our perspective in step 7. And it says in the 12 and 12, if you read it, it says, and one of the great effects of step 7 is that my attitude towards God will change. I found a loving God in step 7. And that prayer had a whole new meaning. And we say, my Creator, isn't Bill divine to think that he starts that prayer with the words that it's about humility. And humility to me is just knowing the order of things. I'm okay being a squirrel. I'm okay being Joe today. Good and bad. I wake up every day and know that I am absolutely forgiven. You know how I know? I woke up. Here, you got another shot. Go have fun with it. That's what I mean. That's what I think we mean when we say this is a spiritual illness. Because a long time ago when I was in Miami, there was an article in Life magazine or in Time magazine about Paradise Lost. This is when cocaine was all over the place in Miami. And here's what it said, the symptoms, the effect of cocaine or alcohol is on an alcoholic or an addict. And it was something so simple that I would have never understood it. It says, it creates a sense of well-being. It's my being that is affected. What alcohol does for me, it makes me okay with my being. That terminal sense of lack goes away. I am absolutely okay being right here with you right now. I'm okay being Joe today. What a gift. I never liked me. When I walked by a mirror, there was a dislike for who I was for as long as I can remember. That terminal sense of lack, that stone in my shoe. And when I practiced this step, that's one of the things that have happened to me in that step. So, and step 8, so if you haven't done step 7 and 6 in a different kind of way, see me afterwards. It's my favorite 2 steps to do with sponsees. It's my favorite 2 steps.